All right, everybody, this is John Stamp, and welcome back to the That's Criminal podcast. That's Criminal is where we talk books, true crime, authors, writing process, and pretty much whatever else crosses my mind in that particular day. And today, we are talking spy thrillers, and we're talking spy thrillers with Matt Scott, author of Surviving the Lion's Den and The Iranian Deception. So this is a good book so far. I'm loving them. They're good, easy reads, and the action's tight. So Matt, welcome.
John, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And so far, giant fan of Carruthers and DeLange. But they met under unfortunate circumstances, but I'm enjoying the ride. to lay it out there, I guess if you want to introduce your series.
Well, first of all, I'm glad you're a fan of Carruthers because, you know, I read your bio and, you know, you have a degree from the University of Florida, but I hate to tell you, Kirk Carruthers was a tight end for Florida State back in the 90s. So if you're a fan of Kirk Carruthers, you're fighting for the other side a little bit. So, you know, here we go, baby. Here we go.
I can live with that. I got my Gator degree for grad school, so it's not like I lived in the swamp, but going. As long as nobody's stealing crab legs down in Florida State anymore, right?
Yeah, no, not any, but the crab legs are sitting next to the national championship trophy, so
they are.
No, when I saw that on your bio, I had to poke fun a little bit, but Surviving the Lion's Den and the Iranian Deception, it's going to be a series of three. I started out with Surviving the Lion's Den simply because I had always been fascinated with Iran. Why does Iran hate us? And I had been reading a lot of spy thrillers, especially, you know, Vince Flynn, Brad Thor. They hooked me up, right? But I was also a fan of the Da Vinci Code, and I wanted to take readers on a tour of Iran. Now, it's hard to do because it's illegal to be American in Iran. And if you go there, you have to have an escort, and chances are the escort is going to be a member of the besieged, right? So I needed a character that had a personal story that would allow the readers to see Iran through his eyes and all these other locations. But I also wanted to, you know, have a spy aspect come into it, because that was important to me, because I've always been into that. So that's kind of where the Tom DeLange and Kirk Carruthers character came in. You know, DeLange gets captured. You know, Kirk Carruthers goes over there to, you know, seek revenge for his grandfather, because the Revolutionary Guard was hunting down remaining members of who were involved in the CIA coup back in 53. So I kind of was able to segue a little bit and have them meet up. And I think it seems from the feedback that I'm getting, it seems like I did that fairly well, which I'm really happy about, because I was kind of concerned about. You know, by the end of Surviving the Lion's Den, I left it so that the readers had to kind of make a choice as to whether or not they thought Kirk was going to join the CIA at the end. I did answer that question in The Iranian Deception. So readers will find that out. But I will say, without giving it away, I will say that when I did The Iranian Deception, I decided to go in a little bit different direction and made Ben Thrasher my main character. Now, Ben Thrasher was a character that was in Surviving the Lion's Den, but he failed on a mission. He has a really big guilt complex. He has some serious emotional issues, and he was just a really fun character to write. So I didn't want to go down the route of having, you know, the Kirk Carruthers character. Okay, he did this. Now he's going to the farm. Now he's going to be my super spy, my main character. I mean, I like the Kirk character, and I'm not going to get rid of him because people really responded well to him. But, you know, that kind of storyline had been done. You know, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's been done. So I kind of like planted a seed with the Ben Thrasher character. And then I use him a little bit more in The Iranian Deception, because he was a fun character to write. And The Iranian Deception, the publisher put me on a pretty tight timeline. So I just had an idea and I went with it. And the premise for The Iranian Deception is that the Supreme Leader is dead. The new Supreme Leader has a secret to take over the Middle East using a connection to the Nazis. And then there's a tie-in with Tom DeLange and Kirk Carruthers. And Ben Thrasher has to save the day. And, you know, I'm working on book three, The Ayatollah Takedown, right now. And I can't say too much about it because I want readers to get to the end of the Iranian Deception and kind of see for themselves a little bit. But I think they're really going to like it. I've put a lot of work into this one, and I'm pleased with it so far.
Yeah, I love the fact that you said it in Iran and that you used the backstory of overthrowing that regime, all those muddy places that we tend to poke our finger in that end up coming back to bite mm-hmm. us so many times yeah. throughout our history. We just can't seem to figure that out yet. But that was one of the questions I was like, because I was like, when I think of research, I'm like, how do you get over to Iran to start knowing streets and stuff, man? I was like, that's a tough one. but yeah. No, you sell it. It feels like you're there. And I love the little piece of, you know, you got to have that escort, and you know right from the start that guy's nothing but a spy. There's just no yeah. way around it, especially in a community yeah. like that. You did mention the intro between, you were a little concerned about the intro between DeLang and Carruthers. And it actually made me chuckle a little bit, because it was cool in that it was nobody knew what was going on. The reader had no idea what was going on. Carruthers had no idea what was going on. Farad had no idea, and DeLang thought he had an idea, and he was completely wrong. So right, he yeah. shows up.
Yeah.
He shows up, and he's like, "Wow, they only sent two guys to get me." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm not here for you." So I'm not. Yeah. I don't want to say too much to give it away, but that scene was a perfect follow-up to a really good fight that you put on.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
you. I was a fan of that. Anytime the Garden Shears come out, I'm just like, okay, I'm in. I can't wait to read this.
Yeah, that's where, when you had your interview with Ema Adair, you know, that's where we get to tap into our dark side a little bit. You can't slap anybody in the office. You can't, you know, cut anybody's fingers off, but you want to, and it's a little therapeutic when you can do it on the pages, right?
Yeah. Yep. Just catharsis of taking out your dark side. Yeah, as long as it doesn't come out at, yeah, go ahead.
My wife read it, and she was like, you got some issues. Well, you married him.
And especially when that comes out at a dinner party, you know, after, you know, people start asking, oh, what you writing about? I'm like, well, I decapitated a couple of people last week with a demon, and I crushed a guy with a car the week before that. And they just start, if they don't know you well enough, you forget you're around strangers. They're just like, yeah, who did we let in our house?
Yeah, exactly. But then, you get to know them, but I mean, it's always fun to see somebody's first reaction to something like that. It really is. And I've actually started kind of enjoying it just to see what their face looks like.
Yeah. And I've just told my wife that whenever I happen to stick my foot in my mouth, I get to now, because I'm an artist. So I get to be eccentric. That's just part of it. So my eccentricity just happens to be a really dark side that I put on paper.
But, yeah, exactly. Nothing wrong with it.
That's part of the art process.
Absolutely.
But you also mentioned your crazy character Thrasher, mm-hmm. that just the emotionally charged kind of a little bit crazy dude is so much fun to write. I had the same thing. I enjoyed a bad guy so much in one of my books, spoilers, that mm-hmm. I had to bring her back. She was psychotic assassin. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, she needs another book. So I had to write an entire second chapter mm-hmm. of that series just to give her the chance to get back on the paper.
Oh, I don't blame you. I mean, when you have a character that's really fun to write, I mean, it's, you just can't stop. You can't. And I kind of did that not only with Thrasher, but with the character Shardell, who was in book one and then ends up being the supreme leader in book two, and he's also there in book three. And you can, because the more you keep them in, the more you can involve them. Now, it does mean you have to, you know, step up your level of creativity a little bit, but that's a gift. You know, that's what I try to explain to writers that are coming up, and when they say they got, you know, they get writer's block, it's like, well, you know, knock wood, but you know, I haven't had that problem. But you know, if you feel like you're having that problem, you're not developing enough. You've taken the characters or the plot as far as it wants to go. So you have to change things up. And that's why I tell people, you know, the delete key is your friend. Don't be afraid of it. You know, sometimes you're going to have, if you have to delete 3,000 words, does it stink? Yeah, it stinks. But you know, look what you did with that 3,000. It doesn't matter that it's deleted. I mean, when I did Lion's Den, my first draft of it was, I would say, at least half different. I mean, DeLang was still there. The kidnapping thing was still there. At least the escape was still there. But it was about three friends that went over to Iran. And it was 130,000 words. You know, it ended up being 86 or 87,000, I think. And before I got published, you know, I had somebody in New York edit it for me. And she's like, you got some work to do. I mean, she's like, you got something, but you need to shorten this up. And, you know, I had a scene where they went into, you know, the old U.S. embassy, which was so much fun to write because I did a lot of research on it. And these all three characters had these big backstories. It was all gone. I mean, 40,000 words gone. And you just kind of take a deep breath, highlight, delete, and then you just move on with it. But at the same time, you know, it doesn't discount the fact that, you know, I wrote those words and I learned a lot writing those words. So it's not a bad thing. But I kind of got off track a little bit here. But yeah, when you have a fun character, you can't give them up.
Oh, no, not at all. And if you look at it the right way, you know, for me, it's always been, I word vomit that first 100,000 and then I go back with a scalpel and just start chipping away at whatever's left. And, but absolutely, that does hurt. That, those multi-page deletions that just sticks with you.
Yeah. I, with books two and three, I didn't have quite as much of that because I feel like my craft improved a little bit. I kind of think of it as a piece of string that has little loops in it and you just kind of tighten them up, you know, as you go along. So Iranian Deception and Ayatollah Takedown, they've been pretty much the same, but there were instances that I had to tighten up a little bit. But this one, you know, you swallow your pride, you do it and you move on, but you learn a lot when even when you have to delete it, you think about what you did. It just didn't fit. Yeah, that's all that's happening. It just didn't fit. It doesn't mean what you wrote was bad. It just means that for the story you want to write, it's not going to work. So, you know.
Yeah, and when it comes down to, for me, my gauge has been, and it's only through the last two or three books, but the less time when I can look in my word count and see a change in the amount of times I say that or had or and. Or but mm-hmm. like if I see those filler worthless words leaving, I feel like it's more crisp. Even if, you know, it's 100,000 words, but I can see that number dwindling with every draft. That's one of those measurements. I'm like I have to be getting a little more clear, right? Yeah. There's something good happening.
Yeah, and I'm actually at that stage right now with book three. You know, trying to cut the word count down just a little bit more because, you know, I don't know about the big guys at Simon & Schuster or Penguin Random House or Doubleday, but independent publishers like mine, you know, word count matters. So you got to try and keep it as lean as you can. I don't think I'm going to be as lean as they want me to be on book three, but, you know, they're going to have to deal with it because I'm not altering the story, but I will cut it down. So, you know, there's not a lot of, you don't want it to lag. It's, you know, chapter, you know, it doesn't need to be 1200 words when it can be, you know, 1125, 1150, you know, whatever it is. So you got to be concise because the more concise you are, that's what keeps the readers turning the pages.
Yeah. And I want it to be crisp. So yeah, when I get to the point, if I'm to the point being like, we could move on, be like, oh, okay, there's another page I got to delete. That's just, but it's hard. It gets real.
Yeah. It is. But you know, in the end, you just have to have your mind on the goal at the end, right? It's all to make it better. And that's what your goal as a writer is. It's not what you're writing right now. It's the finished product. I mean, that's how I feel about it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And since we're talking process, do you have a defined time or are you one of those guys that just kind of fits it in during the workday or late at night? How do you sit down and knock these things out?
So usually what will happen is, you know, since we're working from home these days, you know, I'll do my 8 to 5, I'll come downstairs, you know, talk to my wife, we'll have dinner, we'll spend some time together. And my wife, you know, she goes 90 miles an hour in a 35 zone, so during the workday. So she usually kind of crashes on the couch between 8:30 and 9. And I just, I'm a bit of a night owl. So I tend to try and make good use of my time. So I'll come back upstairs and write. And the first thing I'll do is I'll reread a chapter that I wrote the night before. It's kind of a good way for me to break the ice and get in the groove. And there is some editing associated with it. Maybe not a lot, but just enough to say, you make sure you want to go in that direction for the next chapter. And then I'll write the next chapter. I don't have a set number, but I kind of followed Stephen King's advice in the On Writing book, which was anywhere between 1,000 and 1,500. 1,500 usually tends to be my number. I don't know why, that's just kind of how it turns out. But my hard and fast rule is I never stop in the middle of a chapter. If I start a chapter, I have to finish it. I don't care what time it is, you know, it has to be finished. Now, if I write a short chapter that's like 500, 700 words, then I'll go ahead and I'll write, one more, because I don't feel like I quite put all of myself into it. And then, once that chapter is done, I don't go back and edit. I save it, put it down, and I come back, I come back the next day.
Yeah, that's a good habit, doing that little bit of catch up before you start banging away on the keyboard. It gets you get your mindset right, no matter what else exactly. Going on, kind of cleans it out.
Yeah, and it's like stretching, right? It's a mental stretch, It gets you back in the groove, right? And I'm always looking at my outline, and I'm not much of an outliner. Some people are total pantsers. Brad Thor says he writes totally at the seat of his pants. Me, I'll take, I'll just put it on an Excel spreadsheet. I'll just, outline a third of the book, one line, and I'll just say, John goes here. And, okay, so if he's going to go there, what's the next step? What's the next step? And I usually get about 2/3 of it done by way of outline. Excuse me. And, then kind of panic sets in. I was like, oh my God, I didn't outline all of it. How am I going to do this? But that's a good thing. That's where, stress and panic, I want panic, maybe not panic, but stress adds in. That's where, it kind of pushes you to make sure that you get it right. And then as I go along, I'll add chapters that make sense, and maybe I'll take one out. And if you haven't seen Ben Thrasher for, 3 or 4 chapters, maybe I'll move one up and move one down. And that's also where I keep track of my word count. But that's what works for me. I wish I could say, I could just look at a map and say, okay, I'm going there today. Yeah. I have to say either north, east, south, or west. I got to have a guide. But hands off, heads off to the people who can, are total pantsers and can write like that. I wish I could, but everybody has their own process, and that's what's worked for me so far.
Yeah, and it baffles me that a guy with as tight a plots as Thor can just be like, I'm gonna knock out a novel. I got an idea. That's it. I'm gonna go. I can't even get started unless I have an opening hook and a climax. I gotta know how the fight's gonna go at the end, and I gotta know pretty much, since every book opens with a murder within the first 10 pages, I gotta know who I'm gonna kill first and why. And route the story to make sure A gets to Z, but then it's
so know the ending. So ending when you start.
I've got an idea of the ending when I start. I can tell you in at least 3 books that's completely changed about 3/4 of the way through, because the characters just decided to go their own way. But I feel like if I don't know what the end fight looks like, feel like I'm going to get, like you said, 2/3 of the way through and just get a cold sweat and have zero idea what I'm doing next.
Right.
It freaks me out.
I can understand that. Yeah. For me, I pretty much know how it's going to end. I mean, I won't say, I don't set anything in concrete, because again, delete key is your friend. You have to go where the process takes you and where the keyboard takes you. Because one of the things that's really worked for me is that, I tend to be an overthinker. It comes from, I'm just that type of an analyst. But when I'm sitting at the keyboard, if I have an idea, I just go with it. And that has been one of the best things about this writing process, is looking at something, not knowing how I'm going to get myself out of it. And then I get in the keyboard and I'm like, now I've got it. That work. And I take the idea and I just run with it. I don't stop. I just go with it. And, and that's been fun. And it really helps.
Yep. Do you, and I should lay it out there, since we've been saying stuff like pantsers, for all those of you who don't write, there's like 2 camps in the writing world. There's people who are plotters and people who have been called pantsers because they theoretically write by the seat of their pants. and usually can nail somebody down into some kind of, there's hybrids out there, but for the most part, people either need a plan to start with, or they can just wing it. And I am not one that can wing it. So
I wish I had that skill. I mean, yeah. Brad Thor, that's why he's the champ of the thriller, in my estimation. That is not, you know, put down anybody else in the genre, because I love them all. But I mean, to me, he's the guy. He's the guy that's got the belt right now, in my estimation.
Yeah, but the cool thing is, when you say that, you know, the guy who's a champ right now, it's in this world, and it's a weird thing because it's very uncommon in the rest of the world. But because this dude's on top right now, doesn't mean that we're you know, wanting to see ill happen to them, or there's a competition to take readers away. It's everybody. No. It's weird. All writers will cheer each other on to,
you know, exactly.
It's a cool part of the community. I had no idea it was going to be a thing when I got into it.
Yeah. And that has been very pleasantly surprising. And it's good, because here's the thing. If you look at, you want to be a little bit competitive, right? I mean, competition is good, but you have to look at it as, you know, you're within the genre. So if the genre is doing well, we're all going to do well. So you want Brad Thor to do well. You want Brad Taylor to do well. Jack Carr, you know, Kyle Mills, you know, Joel Rosenberg, you know, any of them. So Matt the Scott. Better the genre. Yeah, hopefully I'll get there one day. I'm trying. Yep. But I mean, because they get the people in the door. Those are the ones that get the people in the door. And then if, you know, then word starts to spread. Well, if you like, you know, if you like him, you like, you know, you're going to like John Stamp, or, you know, whoever. And that's why it's a community that really works. And I am really, really grateful for that. Hopefully one day, you know, I'll be able to get up to Thriller Fest, which I have not been able to do yet. I think I would love to. It's got a heavy price tag to it, so I have a hard time convincing my wife we can spend that kind of money, because I'm still trying to recoup what I've spent so far. But one day I'm going to get up there. But, you know, everybody, you know, from writers to readers to podcasters to reviewers to bloggers, I mean, it all seems like everybody wants to be in the community. And the cool thing, one of the other cool things, is most of the authors, maybe not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them have, you know, very good social media presence, and they can't answer everybody, although Jack Carr does a pretty darn good job of answering everybody. But, you know, a lot of them, you know, they'll answer back. I mean, I remember I got a tweet or I got a like from Patricia Cornwell the other day, and I'm like, whoa, it just makes your day when somebody does it. And, you know, if I hear from a reader that, you know, never heard of, and, you know, they love it, it makes my day. So, you know, circle of life, Simba.
That's right. Yeah, it was funny. You know, you like something or retweet something, and I remember it was Carr. I retweeted something. It was probably a cool gun, but and then he hit back, and I was like, oh, hey, yeah, that's cool. They do exist.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And because we all know how hard it is to be successful.
Oh yeah,
in the publishing industry. I mean, self-publishing is not a bad thing. I mean, I think Ama is self-publishing. Wasn't her L novels, aren't they self-published?
She's got, I forget who she works through, but she works with somebody. I forget.
Okay.
I think the graphic novel was independent, or through somebody who helped her out with the art and stuff like that. But I forget who she works with.
Yeah, I mean, I think self-publishing has turned out to be a great thing, because it allows people to really get there, you know, express themselves. But it does, at the same time, you have to be careful of saturating the market, you know. And I want independent authors to get noticed. I mean, that is the goal, right? I mean, you want to live your passion, you want to be successful, but it's gotten to the point where, you know, everybody has to hustle, and I actually think that that's a good thing. The problem with that is that if you talk to publishers these days, they're telling authors that they need to have more social media presence. And I'm not saying that's bad, but I'm saying, you know, it's good for them, because guess what? That means they have to do less work. And if you're an author, it's kind of like, okay, I wrote the book, you know, you guys need to do your job too. And I think that's one of the things that I think the publishers especially the big ones, are starting to get away with a little bit more. And I better not run my mouth too much because I don't want to put anybody down. But that's what I'm seeing, and that's what I'm hearing. And my agent has been very good about sending out a monthly newsletter that lets people know what's going on in the industry, and who she's been talking to and the conferences she's been going to, and that's the feedback that she gets. And so I think I've had to step up my social media presence in a way that, and I've had to learn things that I never thought I could learn. So it makes you a better writer. It makes you stronger. You acquire skills that you didn't know you could have. But I think everybody's got to do their piece on it. And hats off to the self publishers, man. I don't think I could do it. I was fortunate enough to get an agent and get a publisher, but self-publishing, man, it's tough. It's really tough.
Yeah. And I wanted a partner going into the industry. I didn't want to throw stuff out there because if you're the only one looking at it, you can't see the weaknesses. So for the first couple, I hired out an editor and then submitted it to publishers and got a small publisher that they really weren't, they didn't know what they were doing. Their covers, it was odd. One of them folded. But so then when they come off contract, then I put them out myself, and there was only one. I lost my mind. I think it went insane for a little bit and decided I had to write Die Hard in a Medieval Castle in like 2017. But that was just me. That was me. That was my foray into the fantasy world. And it was, when you got to research horses for 2 days to do like a 5-page, journey from one place to the next, and that's it. It's like, man, it's so much easier just to have car chases and shoot people. I don't know if I'll be going back into the high fantasy world anytime soon, but it was cool. But just building that world's wholly different. But that one was a purely independent project I did. But I like having those resources, and I don't mind sharing in whatever revenue there might be to have those professionals backing me up, which is good.
I think anybody who wants to get even if you eventually self-publish, having another set of eyes on it is just well worth it, especially if you're a debut novelist. Everybody wishes they were the next Tom Clancy or Dan Brown. Everybody has those thoughts, and you want to be that, and that's a good thing. But you really need to have somebody take a look at it. And I think that's really the best thing that probably happened to me for Lion's Den, is that I had a really good editor named Caroline Tolley, who I hired independently. She used to work at Simon & Schuster, but now she kind of does her own thing. And she gave me notes and, you might want to change here. And it was very constructive criticism. It wasn't like, no exclamation point or what are you doing? It was very good, and it was helpful. And I think that that first edit, it's always going to be gut wrenching. It's just going to be, because your first novel, no matter how long it is, it's your baby, right? I mean, that was your dream. So editing it is a little hard, but you accept it, and you just understand that, the person you're giving it to is doing the best job possible to make your novel better. And they may be friendly to you, but that doesn't mean they're your friend. And that's a good thing, because there's that degree of separation. So I would always recommend that, because a second set of eyes can do wonders for you. And it certainly did for me. And I think because the version of Lion's Den that ended up selling was pretty darn close to the second draft that came out.
Yeah, and Clancy and Brown aren't Clancy and Brown without that same type of resource, and it can't be, it's got to be somebody who doesn't mind punching you. You got to make sure it's somebody who will punch you, and you can't get mad about it when they punch you because you asked them to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. You just have to understand, you have to welcome the mistakes, because that's how you're going to learn, and that's how you're going to get better.
Yep. So going through the end of the book business, I think I heard you mention it on another podcast, but you had a wild number of rejection letters. That
96
rejection letters.
96.
I
still have trouble facing that, because I thought I had a really good query letter. I didn't think it was weak. Now I can say this, when Lion's Den, the proposal for Lion's Den, it did actually reach Emily Bessler's desk. And she, even though she rejected me, she said, it had a really good hook. So, I mean, that gave me hope, right? I mean, when the editor of, Brad Thor and Jet Carr says, you got something good, then you got something good. So that gave me some hope. But query letters, you just have to take the punches and run the gauntlet. I mean, I wish I had a better answer for prospective authors out there. Some of them, you get 3, 3, 10, whatever, and you get one. Others like me, it takes 96. What's meant to be is meant to be. But query letter definitely matters. Maybe I did it at the wrong time of year. Maybe I did it at a time where, some of the literary agents were kind of getting tired of reading the same thing. You never know. I mean, there's so many unknowns out there, and you just do the best you can. I finished Lion's Den by September or November 2020 or no 19, and then I started querying in April of 20. Just as COVID was getting started.
Just in time.
So I'm sure that had something to do with it. I kind of thought, my thought process at the time was, well, everybody's working from home, and most literary agents work from home anyway. I didn't really see a whole lot of difference, but it was nature just kind of threw me a curveball, threw everyone for a curveball, but for me, as trying to be a published author, that was the curveball that I had to deal with. So I wish I had a better answer for somebody, who's looking to get published or get an agent, in less rejection letters than I did, but that's my story.
You said it. Yeah. I think I would say I would hope somebody could get it in less rejection letters. And cause I stopped counting at 60 for Blood Red Ivory. But at the same time, you got to have that experience in this game. I really think you do, because it just, you got to have that thick skin, especially, as an author putting stuff out there. I think facing rejection is one of those gates that you got to walk through, which you're better for it. I mean, because think about all the other stuff you run into in the world, and you're just like, you haven't told me no 96 times.
Yeah, exactly.
Beat that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you have to. I mean, the difference between being a published author and being an unpublished author is that published authors never stop. And that's just kind of the mentality that I had. I'm going to find a way, and eventually it happened for me. Now, luckily on the publishing side, the book sold within 3 weeks, I think. So, that made things a little bit easier, because even when you get an agent, you may not get published. Somebody may not be interested in it. Your agent can keep it for months on end and shop it around until, a publisher that wasn't interested in thrillers in October, maybe, when May comes around, maybe they are. There's that waiting game too, but luckily that happened.
Yep. Yeah. And, but like I said, there's no rhyme or reason to any of it. How polished your query letter is doesn't matter. It could be they just, had to wait too long for their coffee that day and put them in a bad mood. It could be as simple as that.
Exactly. So. I mean, you may as well be shaking a magic eight ball.
I always thought that was kind of fun. It was like opening up Google, typing in literary agent, and then throwing a figurative dart at the screen. I was pretty like, yeah, much. I'll try that one.
Pretty much. Now I will say this, that the for people who are looking for literary agents, the Writer's Digest does put out a book of literary agents, you know, every year, and it's listed in accordance to genre. So that is a good point of reference for people, and that is what I used. So that does help. But in the end, you know, everybody runs the gauntlet.
Yep. And yeah, I use that one. And then also the agent, I think it's Agent Query online, that database.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Agent Query. Yeah, no, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yep. But it's just all part of the game that I think has been fun. But, you know, it's one of those things where I started this thing, whole thing, because it's fun. So if I'm not having fun, I'm not doing it. So it's all part of the experience.
Exactly. And, you know, it's my hope that, you know, one day, you know, if either of these gets, you know, made into a movie or, you know, it sells well, you know, that's the story I get to tell, is that, you know, I got rejected 96 times. I think Flynn was close to that. I don't remember what his number was, but his number was pretty high. And the story is that he took every rejection letter and he taped it to his wall until he finally made it. So I kept that in mind, you know.
And sadly, because I always thought of that too, that that'd be fun to have that big spike of letters, but now all of ours are emails. So it's like,
exactly.
I'm not taking the time to print all that out.
No,
I will tell you though. Much like Crichton, you know, when you read a Crichton book, it reads like a movie. Your Surviving the Lion's Den blocks out like their movie scenes. You know how Michael Crichton used to do that? You can just, I remember specifically in Jurassic Park, I thought Sphere was written much the same way. And his last book, Micro, it was never optioned, but his just style reads really well to be adapted to the screen. And I got the same vibe with Surviving the Lion's Den. Yeah. Yeah. It just moves.
Thank you.
It flows really well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah. I had there's a lot of little plot lines in Lion's Den that I have to tie up at the end. So I'm glad you feel that way. I think the feedback I've gotten so far from, you know, the other readers that have liked it has said the same. But I think it was Stephen Hendricks' book review said it's a tall and wide thriller. Now I didn't think of that before I gave it to him, but I, you know, after I got it, I was like, you know what? Yeah, he's right. But I'll take it. You know, I'll take it. There are worse things to be said. I had a lot going on, and it had to be concise and flow well in order for it to work. So I'm so happy that you feel that way.
Yeah. It takes a lot to, especially, I mean, those good spy thrillers, they got a bunch going on and it all just comes back in the end. So that's the plot's tight. I just think it flows really well.
And Thank you.
As far as putting that together, we talked about, you know, why you wanted to use Iran. But even, you know, the fact of when you write this book, you set it up, you set it in Iran, a country that's hostile. Americans can't go there without a whole lot of oversight and a whole lot more surveillance.
Yeah.
How much time did you put into researching? And what were the things that jammed you up? Like, what were some of the eccentricities that you just got? And there was like, was there anything in that culture that you were like, okay, I got to change something in my plot because that is not going to work there?
Well, I don't think I got jammed up, but I had a lot to work with because there were, you know, when I started researching it, there were so many different sites and spots that I wanted to try and feature, and eventually I had to wean it down. Because location was really important to me. But, you know, thankfully, you know, with YouTube these days, everybody's got a dash cam on their car, or if they're going into one of the touristy sites like the Zadi Tower or something like that, you know, they take their phones and you can really see, you know, what's going on from a first person point of view. So that really helped. I did my traditional research, you know, on the internet, looking at all the spots. I tried to be as good as I can about finding stuff that maybe people didn't know about, but in the end, for Iran, it's not like Paris where you're looking for, you know, a secret passage that not a lot of people know about. For Iran, they want to know what it is, why it's there and what the description is. And then there were a couple of really good documentaries on Amazon Prime, One was called Everything's Forbidden or and Everything is Possible, something like that. And you really got to see how Iran operates in the shadows of the people trying to live under the regime versus, you know, what they have to do outside their doors. And that's really what I wanted to try and focus on, because, you know, there are some really good Iranian people out there that really, you know, they do want peace, but it's the iron fist that runs that place. So I think I probably had to be the most careful with the Revolutionary Guard, because I wanted to try and make sure that I got everything that they do correctly, you know, because people forget, you know, the Revolutionary Guard, there's different branches of it. You know, you got the Quds Force that, you know, handles everything overseas. You got the besieged that's domestically. You got the aerospace, and you got the army. So it's not just one force, you know, but luckily, you know, with the Revolutionary Guard, you can kind of get away with it a little bit, because in the end, they're all in the same boat. But, you know, somebody from the Quds Force isn't going to come knocking on your door. It's not going to be them. It's going to be the besieged. So those are the kind of things that I had to be careful about. But I was surprised. Those documentaries really helped, because you learned between that and the follow-ups. Like there's a scene at the Zine ski resort that I don't know if you've gotten to yet, but the besieged gives, it's there, they're there, but there's a lot of leeway that's associated with it. And you have to learn why that leeway exists. And it's because, you know, these are the customers that bring in the money. When in a country that's really has a lot of economic sanctions against them, you know, it's going to go where the money is, but they're only going to let you get away with so much. So that was kind of the balance, is that I didn't want anybody, any of the characters that are operating on the black market to go too far. So that was probably the line that I had to walk, because I wanted to be as realistic as I could about what was happening there, but I couldn't take it too far. But there was one scene where I was talking about the, you know, the way they make beer in Iran, because, you know, it's non-alcoholic beer, but they give you the non-alcoholic beer, and that's actually the hardest part. So you just have to re-ferment the beer to add the alcohol back in. And I was like, oh, these guys have figured out how to get around it. And that's, so that was pretty cool. That was fun.
Yeah, the creativity under those regimes, like you said, the people just want to live like everybody else does. And even, yeah. You know, I noticed in some of the places when I traveled in different places that were more controlled than this, you know, even the dudes in uniform, there's no other choice. They, you know, if they want to live, they have to be a part of this group. That doesn't mean that they hate any, you know, there's none of that that fervent, you know, like Nazi pride that you would equate with, you know, the World War II era. They're just like, I need a job and I got to wear this stupid uniform and serve these ridiculous leaders to get the job done sometimes.
Yeah.
Other times but.
Yeah, no, you're always going to have that percentage of the Revolutionary Guard that you know, the fervent believer. I would say probably that number's 20%, 25 maybe. You can even go as high as a third probably, but I don't know that it's that high. But the other guys, you know, they do what they have to do. And for the people that are operating in the black in the black market, you know, the guys that are making the beer and selling it, that just goes to show you that freedom will always find a way. And I think that, you know, it's hard to tell when Iran's time is going to come, but the sanctions that are in place, you know, it's going to end up crippling them. And at some point, because all the Iranians, you know, they want their iPhones, they want to be able to, you know, post to social media, although Instagram is the only allowed social media in Iran, but Twitter and Facebook they want. So something's going to happen. It's hard to tell when. The current supreme leader is suffering from health conditions. Obviously it's a secret. I've heard things as like liver cancer, or prostate cancer. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens, you know, within the next 10 years or so, because that could be Iran's chance. But you don't know what's going on behind the scenes, because the media is so closed off there. You don't know who's being groomed in the background.
Yep. Yep. But that's funny. You were kind of channeling some Goldblum there for a second. Yeah. Life finds a way, freedom finds a way. I do like true. That quote. I might use that. I might use that at some point.
Yeah, no, good. By all means. Just don't ask me to do a Jeff Goldblum impression, you know. Oh god. Although, you know, hey, that's about as good as it gets for me.
Right. Yeah, my family can quote, even my 5-year-old can quote movie lines just seeing it once. I can't do it. Like, I know it's a genetic trait passed down from my wife's side of the family, because no matter what, I've seen Tombstone like 60 times. I still can't quote Doc Holliday.
Really?
Yeah. Really? My kid can watch some ridiculous like Lego show and just start whipping that stuff off like it's his job. And I'm like, yep, it's genetic. It's gotta be. I just don't have the mind for it.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. I can do it. Once I hear something, you know, I'm your Huckleberry, you know. It's in there. I mean, you know, it's there. It's not going anywhere.
See, I'm fairly certain I would screw that up. All right. So I got, you mentioned Flynn, you mentioned Thor and Brown. Who, was there anybody in particular that really put you on that road that you read when you were a kid and was like, I'm going to be a writer, or did you just kind of grow into it?
Okay, so I this is a little of a long story, so I'll try and make it as short as I can for you.
It's an open format, man. Take your time.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, as a kid, I did not like reading. I did not like it. I did not like, you know, the assignments they were giving us for summer reading. I hated Watership Down. I hated The Good Earth. And I resisted it. I really did. So it wasn't until really after college. I'd always had the craft down. I knew I had a knack for it, but I didn't know where it was going to take me. And I studied under General Sam Wilson, who was at one point, he was the president of the college at the time, but at one point during his career, he was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So that's kind of where I caught the bug just a little bit. And then when I got out of college, you know, the phenomenon of the Da Vinci Code came out. So, I mean, you had to read it. I mean, it's one of those books, you just doesn't happen all the time. So you have to. So I got into Dan Brown. I read all of his books, and then I was kind of struggling a little bit. And it was divine intervention. One day I was going on the elevator at work, saw a guy, I was talking spy novels with him, and never seen him before, never seen him again. He's like, you have to read Vince Flynn. So I went to Books a Million right after work. I think I got Act of Treason. You know, I was hooked, you know, started reading all of them. You know, then it led me to Thor and to Carr and Baldacci. But, you know, I think I could probably credit, you know, two besides Flynn for me. When Baldacci wrote Long Road to Mercy, my family's originally from Virginia Beach, and I went back for Thanksgiving, and it was the week before Thanksgiving actually, and he was in Williamsburg doing the book signing, and it was my turn. I shook his hand, and I was like, I was getting ready to be 40 at the time. I was like, is 40 too old to write your first novel? And I kid you not, he stopped mid-signature and looks up at me and is like, hell no, you know, the industry could use some good young writers. Now, I didn't know if I should be happier that he thought 40 was young, or that this legendary man of the industry was telling me to go forth with my mythic destiny. But at that point, I had no excuses. I had no excuses, right? So I just decided I was going to do it. And the Iran thing, you know, I just always wanted to know more about it, because, I mean, you know, anything that goes into Iran rarely makes its way out. And there was a lot of curiosity as to, you know, why do they hate us? What happened in the coup in 53? So I've always had that in my mind, but Joel Rosenberg, you know, his five book series, you know, that started with The Last Jihad and the Ezekiel Option. Those were some of the best novels I think I've ever read. But the series that followed that was a series about the 12th Imam, and those were set in Iran. And, you know, that really helped. And, you know, then I read Fred Burton's Beirut Rules book. At that point, you know, I had no excuses. I needed to find out. I was getting a little frustrated with my 8-to-5 job. It's like, you know, let's take this baby for a spin and see what it can do. Yep. And, you know, I, you know, hopefully, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with the book sales. I continue to hope that they do well, but it's something that I wanted to do, and I, you know, on my deathbed, I can say that, you know, I did it. No regrets.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, those first two, like I said, surviving the lion's den, I'm having fun with, but you mentioned it's a 3-part series. Did you block it out to be just 3 parts, or did you see Carruthers and DeLange growing old together? Like, you know, Tubbs and
Crockett, Tubbs and Crockett.
Crockett and Tubbs. Yeah.
So funny story about that. So, you know, I wanted to just do the one, and because, you know, I'm always a big believer in, like, let's test things out and see how it goes first. Yeah. But my publisher said, well, I like it, but I don't just want one. I want a series. So, you know, my agent calls me up, and I had kind of spitballed a couple of ideas, you know, about what I wanted to do. And he says, the publisher wants it, but they want a series. What are the names of your other 2 books, and what are they about? And I had to come up with the ideas like that. So I just had the ideas, and I just ran with it, and I just crossed my fingers and hoped that it worked. And it is a series of 3, with my publisher speaking volumes. So, you know, the third book will fulfill my contract, and we're just going to have to kind of wait and see what happens after that. Cause you know, I need to recoup my investment. There is a business side of this for me and my wife. So, you know, we have to, you know, make sure that, you know, it's profitable. It gets noticed. You know, we want it to, you know, I want it to be the best thing that could ever happen to me. I really do. Mm-hmm. But it's a tough industry. So we have to see, but I can say honestly that, you know, I've loved writing these 3, and the series turned out the way that I, for me personally, as the author, it turned out the way I wanted it to. And I hope the people like it. And you know, it's up to the readers as to what happens next, because in the end, you know, the books may be written by me, but they're for the readers out there. Once it's published, it doesn't belong to me anymore. It belongs to them. And I hope that they respond in a way that, you know, makes them want more.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to call anybody up, but I have heard authors say that they'll go back and edit once they hit that published. And for me, I know that there's problems in my books. I know that there's gaffes. I know that there's issues, and some of them, like a plot problem, a character problem, I refuse to go back and like re-edit something that I already hit publish on. I just,
no,
I don't think that's fair to, no, it feels like a mulligan, not. And I can't do it. Yeah.
No, so. No, I think once you, if you, you know, no matter if you're self-publisher or you're traditional published, you know, once you go through it with your publisher or with, you know, whoever, once you submit it to be published, that's it. It doesn't belong to you anymore. And because it's not right, if you change things, it's not right to the readers who read it, you know, 3 months ago under, you know, certain circumstances, and, you know, 3 months later, somebody else reads something different. That's not fair. You have to, you know, when you get published, you write a book, it is an agreement between the author and the readers that this is the product I have for you. And I, you know, because they are giving you the most precious thing in the world. They are giving you their time, and there is no more precious commodity to an author than a reader's time. So you have to be fair with them.
Yep. And as a reader and a writer, you know, that's a big investment for most people, you know, got the work, got the kids, got the dog, got all this stuff. And then to take that time out of the day and actually read your work is very important. It's not something to be messed with, I don't think.
No, and it's a way to build trust, because yep. If you know, they like your first book, you know, hopefully they'll read the second and third and the fourth and whatever the case may be. But it is the beginning of a relationship, and you know, the world is run by relationships, whether it's you know espionage, you know, State Department, you know, whatever the case may be. It is a matter of trust, and you know, I don't feel like the author can violate that.
No, it's not fair. So, but I will say, man, we've been going about an hour, so I'm not going to keep you too much longer on a Tuesday night. But I do have one question. Given your genre and given the influences that you've given me over the last hour, John Clark or Mitch Rapp?
Mitch Rapp. Gotta go, Mitch Rapp. Mitch Rapp. I you know, I will forever fall at the feet of Mitch Rapp and Vince Flynn. I have to. I wish I had been able to meet him. I really do.
Me too.
He came to Raleigh one time, and it was around the time where he announced that he had cancer, and it was on a weekday night. I had something to do the next day, and I just couldn't go. And you know, we just never got to meet him. But I wish I had been able to meet him. And you know, that's no reflection on John Clark. John Clark is a badass, but you have to go with the horse that brought you to the show. And Vince Flynn did that for me. I mean, that's his plots weren't overly complicated, right? But it was the characters. He made you hate those villains so bad that it was therapeutic for you when Mitch finally killed him. And that's kind of what I grew up on. You know, watching wrestling helped in that respect a lot of ways.
You invested in these characters. The Iron Sheik. Yeah, that's why you wanted to go to write something in Iran. The Iron Sheik.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Hulkamania, baby. But you know, in order for Hulkamania to live, the Iron Sheik has to make it hard for him.
Yeah, I will tell you, I like Rapp's backstory better because I grew up right outside of Syracuse. So as a kid, reading that this assassin was just a pissed off college kid out of Syracuse, I was like, yeah. Oh yeah, because my dad got his MBA there. I grew up going to lacrosse games and basketball games, and so yeah, when I first got to Mitch Rapp, it was like, oh, he's an angry freshman from Syracuse. I love it. but on the same hand, I grew up, I vacuumed up all of Tom Clancy starting at like age 9. So when I got to Without Remorse, I was just like, I think this is the most amazing thing I've ever read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, it was really good. That Amazon movie did not do it justice.
Oh, that Amazon movie. I like Michael B. Jordan. I think that's who he was, but
yeah,
it just was not done right. That if they'd have set that thing in the 70s, you know, stick to the plot line. I mean, 70s muscle cars and you know, it's still working ops in that Vietnam era. That would have been crazy.
Yeah.
That
would have been crazy. Oh yeah, it would have been good. I mean, you have to, you know, Clancy's books were so technical and so long that, you know, you had to be very Hollywood has to be very careful about who they choose. I mean, Hunt for Red October, it will forever be my favorite. I mean, I can watch that movie over and over and over and never get tired of it. Patriot Games was pretty good. So was Clear and Present Danger. You know, The Sum of All Fears, it was okay. Yeah. But at that point, you started to see, you know, where Hollywood was going creatively with it, and they were kind of withdrawing from it. So, you know, they had, you know, Mace Newfield was the producer, I think, you know, at the time on the two Harrison Ford movies. And they really cherry picked what worked well in those books, because there's, you know, Clancy was so technical, it was hard to get through a lot of that stuff, you know. But they also knew what worked well and what didn't. And those movies did good. And you have to be very careful with Clancy. And I'm hoping that, you know, maybe they learned their lesson a little bit. I do like the Jack Ryan series on Amazon.
Yeah.
I think they've done that some good justice, even though it's just the characters, but I think they've done the characters justice. But you know, you never know. I mean, with Bentley and Greeny and Cameron, you know, going on with the series, there's a lot to choose from there. But I'm hoping that with the success of, I hope two things happens. Number one, with the success of The Terminal List and The Gray Man on Netflix, that Hollywood will start looking harder at the genre and see how much there is to choose from. Because the fact that Brad Thor does not have one of his books out in movies is just a tragedy. I don't know how that hasn't happened yet. But you know, for selfishly, I hope maybe they'll start looking at mine. You never know. Could happen, right? I did send a copy of this to Robert Rodriguez, because I love Robert Rodriguez's movies. I really do. But at the same time, because of the success of those movies, they have to learn what the producers did, producers, writers, and directors did right, because we've seen that there's a good way for those really great novels to go wrong.
Yeah.
And you know, you can get a little creative with it. I haven't seen The Gray Man yet. I've been dealing with some stuff here at home. But from what I've heard is that as an adaptation, it was okay. But as an action movie, it was really good. And if that is the case, fans of the Gray Man novel, Gray Man series, will forgive them because the idea is you have to do the characters justice and you have to do the work justice. You can take, you know, your creative leeways. And American Assassin, man, I was so disappointed with that. I mean, There were things that they did right, but you know, they just did. I mean, they basically ignored the book. I mean, that wasn't right. I think the kid that they had cast, the kid they had cast as Rap was, he wasn't bad. He had the look, but I envisioned Rap being, you know, a little bit bulkier, a little bit more intimidating, and I don't think I was ever quite intimidated by him.
Yeah, the cast was great. Between that kid and Keaton, they were the great cast. But they departed from the character. And it's just like you said with those Harrison Ford Clancy movies stand out because Harrison Ford nailed Jack Ryan. And even though it's a departure, Jim, the new Jack Ryan from the Amazon show, he's captured the character and captured that
John Krasinski.
Humbleness.
Yeah, John Krasinski.
John Krasinski. I call him Jim from The Office. when they stay true and they capture who the readers know that character is, it's going to work no matter how far they depart on the plot. And I think what they did wrong was where with Without Remorse on Amazon is they captured the kind of grit. Michael B. Jordan got the character. They just didn't. I mean, it wasn't supposed to be just a nice gift wrapped family. It was a girl that he had just met, and he went laid waste because of almost a total stranger. You know, they just missed it. They completely missed the spirit of the book. But
yeah, that's all and right. I think they really need to have, you know, their test audiences need to change a little bit, and they need to be people who have read the book. You know, you're always going to have the diehard people that don't want anybody to depart from the novel whatsoever. And, you know, I understand that, but that doesn't work. There are things that you have to cut out. You can't include, and there's the leeway, but you know, there's other people like, you know, you and me that understand where the spirit of the novel is and what they have to do. So I think that's where, you know, Hollywood has to really self-examine the thriller genre, because you can get away with a lot, but there's things that you can't get away with. So
there's a core that has to be abided by.
But now I have a question for you. So you mentioned we've been talking Clancy, Alec Baldwin or Harrison Ford?
Oh God. Well, not even a question, man. It's Harrison Ford was Han Solo and Indiana Jones. So that's not even close. Harrison Ford was Alec Baldwin tried, but he also, Jack Ryan was kind of a busted up. He was, you know, injured, physically injured all the time. Mm-hmm. Harrison Ford, when he's flopping around a set, he's not running around like he's an athlete. He's you know, in Patriot games, he's bumbling his way into saving, you know, those people in the car. It's it just felt more legit.
No, I get that.
And Alec he's polished. He's a polished actor, and Harrison Ford looks like he just walked off of a set design, you know?
No, I get that. Yeah. I actually liked Alec Baldwin just because he had the young look that I saw when I read Hunt for Red October. But to me, you know, when you look at Red October and you look at Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger, the latter two are much more character focused, whereas October was a lot more plot driven. Because when you got Sean Connery, man, I mean, you know, you've got to do, it's more about doing him justice than it was about doing Jack Ryan justice. I mean, Ryan's the hero, but you know, without Connery's character, it didn't work. So I like Baldwin because there was much more of an analyst side of it, and that's kind of what I liked. Patriot Games obviously ended up being, you know, a much more personal story for the Jack Ryan character. And then Clear and Present Danger was its own thing. I mean, it was as much character driven as it was plot driven. And I think Harrison Ford I love Patriot Games, but Clear and Present Danger, man, that was a lot to overcome from a character standpoint. Yeah. And he played every emotion because, you know, the backstabbing by, was it Cutter? Yeah, Cutter. Mm-hmm. Dennis, the National Security Advisor, Cutter, you know, he didn't know how deep he was. And he played that perfectly. I mean, that's what I love about Harrison Ford is he, you know, I've heard rumors about him having great speeches in his scripts, and he'll tell the writer, "I'm not going to do it." And the writer's like, "Why?" He's like, "Well, I can do that with a look." And I mean, at that point, you're just like, yep. Okay, I'm sold. I'm impressed. You know, you just gotta say, "Okay, sir." And you hop to it, and then he proves you wrong. And then you're glad that he did.
And when you mentioned Clear and Present Danger, the sheer amount of character perspectives and plots that they had to wrap up in a movie in that book, they came close to doing that justice. But from Chavez and Clark, and then also, you know, Jack Ryan and all that, that was a very big Ritter. Scope. Yeah, there's so much to tie in there. And they actually got pretty close you know, the limitations of adaptation goes.
Yeah, no, I think they did. I think they did that one good. I really do. Patriot Games is just, for some reason, Patriot Games is one that I can watch over and over and over, and I've never been able to figure out why. But there's just something about it that I like. But October, man, I actually kicked myself the other day because it was $4.99 on sale on iTunes, and I missed it. I was like, I'll get it tomorrow. I'm a little busy, and sure enough, it went up by $10. So yep, I'm gonna get it the next time. Yeah, I'm gonna get it. I still have it on DVD, but you know, we're in the age of convenience here. I want to be able to turn on my Apple TV and not have to get up and put the disc in the DVD player.
Yep. That's right. My little guys actually opened up the drawer the other day, and my 5-year-old's like, "What are these things?" And my 9-year-old, "It's a DVD." And the 5-year-old's like, "Well, what do you do with them?" He's like, "I don't know. They've been here my whole life." I don't even think I could play those anymore. I don't even have a DVD player. I just got a cabinet full of DVDs.
what you ought to do is see if you can find an old cassette tape and an old Walkman and let them see if they can play it. Oh, that would be funny.
That'd be funny. Yep. But man, it's a Tuesday night. I'm gonna let you go. Before I do, I want you to put out your socials or where best to find you.
Yeah, everybody, they can have a website, mattscottbooks.com. That is also my handle on Instagram and Twitter. You can also friend me on Facebook. I don't have a business account. I take it all. Everybody who's my friend, I take it personally. It seems to work for me. If you really want to message me though, I do watch Twitter for messages, but it's not my favorite medium. So Instagram or Facebook is always good, but you can, if you want to email me, you can go out to the website at mattscottbooks.com, and there is a contact me site. And that's where, you know, I recently had an article published in Mystery and Suspense magazine. That's how the editor reached out to me there. So I watch them all. I answer everybody, no matter what. So please reach out to me. I'd love to talk to you.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate you talking to me tonight, man. And again, Surviving the Lion's Den, The Iranian Deception. I can't wait for book 3. And you're gonna have to come back, and we'll chat again about when book 3 comes out.
Absolutely, man. And you're on my swag list forever. And you'll get it all. So you know, that's, once you're on my mailing list, man, you don't get off. So, you know, I'm not going to let you go.
And I did. And I had a note too. But man, that Turvis cup, is that thing is a magnet for people like that. So everybody, Matt sent me a Turvis cup, the clear plastic ones with his cover on it. And that thing, everybody is just like, "Where did you get that?" That was, you know, he sent me a notebook, like a leather bookmark, 2 copies of the book, the swag. I was like I could not believe it. Oh, and by the way, the calligraphy, my mom, my mother-in-law, my wife, all the other toys I'm playing with, they grab the envelope and they're like, look at this calligraphy. Did he do this? I'm like,
I did. Yeah, yeah. I did. And so, and I totally winged it. So it makes my day knowing that they think, you know, it was done well, because I just Googled calligraphy and I was looking how to make the John, the J, you know, look really cool, and the S. That was totally winging. So I thought either, you know, either the people who I've sent it to, including yourself, are going to look at this and say, oh my God, this was done by like a 5-year-old, oh, no, man. Or they're going to think it was done good. But no. Yeah, swag is important, man. Let me show you something. So see if I can get this right here. You got all kinds of like, so there's my Lion's yep. Den leather stamp. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's my S&M logo. And then there's just the S, and you know, you can do stickers, yeah, and stuff like that. You know, it's all fun. This is where the fun it's part awesome, of the writing yeah. process comes in. You know, I'm only going to probably get to do this, you know, once in my life. So, you know, the budget tends to go up, but this is the fun part and I'm doing it. So I'm really glad you enjoyed it.
Oh yeah, I've enjoyed it, and I've immediately like going to get those Tervis cups. Those are amazing. So, thank you very much. And
you're welcome.
That was awesome. But all right, I'm going to sign off. And thanks everybody. We'll talk to you next week.